So it's May 8, 2010 in New Vrindavan, and we're looking about the stigma of being a religious person in modern secular society. If the power goes back on, do I get a projector and a screen?
Sure.
Oh, and now I get a candle?
I suggested this.
Not by my computer, though, please. One time someone put a candle on my computer and then wax gun on my keyboard.
They said that the electricity will come back at 4, so.
Oh, well, I'm supposed to go to 4:30.
Yeah, I'm just...
But by the time you got the projector and the screen in here and set it up, it would definitely be 4:30. Okay. I don't know if that helps any. A little, very little flame. So... The problem of the stigma really became clear to me when I was hearing about our professor, Ravi Gupta, who teaches religion in a university here in America. And one devotee was telling me that basically if you're a teacher of physics and you're also a practicing physicist, that gives you more credibility. You expect your physics teachers, especially at the upper levels, to be practicing physicists. But if you're a teacher of Christianity and you're practicing Christian, that gives you less credibility.
That's right.
In fact, you may lose your job. So if Ravi Gupta, who's a professor of Indian religions, lets on that he's a practicing Vaishnava, he can lose his job. So there's a stigma. You don't know what a stigma is? It's like you're a social outcast. There's something wrong with you. So there's something fine with being a sports fan. That's okay. You know, you can decorate your faces in the colors of your team, and you can jump up and down in the arena when your team's losing or winning. That's completely acceptable. It's completely acceptable to go out and get drunk all night on a Saturday night and have 10 girlfriends or 10 boyfriends. But if you, and it's also okay to go to a place of worship once a week and just be a nominally religious person, but to be a strictly religious person is considered deviant. You're considered an other. And we really want to look at this from the position of deviancy. I was just reading an article in the New York Times about babies, testing babies' sense of morality. And they found that babies prefer other people who look like them. They prefer other people of their same race, for example. And we all tend to have an affinity for people we think are like us. First of all, we tend to have an affinity for human beings over other creatures. Then we tend to have an affinity for human beings who are of our same nationality or same race. I really noticed this when I was traveling for a long time out of America. I was at the airport in Shanghai, and I heard some people ahead of me speaking English and speaking English in an American accent. And immediately I felt a sense of kinship with them. We tend to trust people who we think are like ourselves, and we tend to distrust aliens. Right? There's a fear of anything alien, anything different. We want to have some area of commonality. So we're going to look at this problem of stigma in terms of that we, practicers of Krishna consciousness, are functioning in an alien culture. If you're functioning in an alien culture, you are the aliens. So just like, you know, some science fiction movie, beings come here from another planet. In their own planet, they're normal, and here they're aliens. All right, now I don't usually give a thing from my computer without power, so I hope you can just bear with me a little bit. So I'm thinking about the problems of being stigmatized. I mean, one of the problems is just being excluded from things. One may be excluded from certain activities. One may be excluded from a job, like I was giving the example of a professor. I had this problem when I was doing an internship for my degree, that I was working in a public school, in a elementary public school as an administrator. And if the people there had known that I was a devotee, I would have lost my job. Just on that basis, that the parents would have complained, what's this Hare Krishna or what's this Hindu doing running our school? Having to hide your identity and your practices from the people around you. You know, having to say, well, no, I don't quite eat that kind of food, or no, I don't think I can go out with you, or not being able to just be open. Well, I'm a Hare Krishna devotee. This is my religion. This is what I believe in. This is what I do. What I found during that internship is that I had to do something called identity management. I had to almost pretend that I wasn't a devotee whilst not trying to be a devotee, and I had to pretend to be a non-devotee while not being a non-devotee. You know, you can't really show who you are if people are talking about hunting turkeys or they're talking about whatever. You have to act like you're part of the group, but you can't really reveal who you are, and as soon as you do, you're going to be the alien. You're going to be the outcast. And then there's, of course, pressure to make us lower our standards in order to fit in. And a lot of devotees run into this kind of thing. You know, that in order to be part of the group, in order to get the benefits of the group, we have to stop basically being a devotee. And a lot of our kids have run into this kind of pressure from being stigmatized. I think also sometimes getting a lack of proper attention. I had problems once at a hospital not getting proper medical attention because I went there in a sari. And there's that question, how are people going to treat me? Are they going to take proper care of me? And the other thing is that people assume that we have particular attitudes. Oh, you must be a fanatic, or you must be like a born-again Christian if you're a religious person. You must think like this, you must think like that. All of a sudden we're identified with a particular group. And I thought, what is it that we really want? What we really would like is we'd like to be able to move in all the worlds that we inhabit. We'd like to be able to be who we are. I'm a Hare Krishna devotee. This is what I believe in. This is what I do. And still be able to function at school or at work or wherever we go, in shopping, and just be treated as a normal person and not be treated again as some kind of an alien. So I'm going to put forward a concept here that the problem, again, is that we are dealing with an alien culture. That's our difficulty. So we're going to look. I wonder if that door is open. Can you check? You close the door?
Yeah.
Would you be willing to ask them to keep the kirtan quiet? They've already been asked once. Now it's open. Okay, thank you. The other people are coming through and opening. We'll just have to remember. Please close the door behind you. No, not that one. Other one. When you go through. Thank you. So I'm going to be looking here at research done by people who studied Catholic missionaries. And they came up with a term called enculturalization, which looks at the relationship between religion and culture. So first we're going to define culture. We can say that there's no society without culture, and there's no culture independent of society. Sometimes we use the word culture to mean good culture. Oh, they're a very cultured person. Where everybody should have culture and values. But we're going to be using the culture here in a neutral sense. We would say that culture is the immaterial or cognitive realities of meaning and values as they're expressed in a materialized form through oral and written language, symbols, rites, and artistic and aesthetic forms. So what things mean and what values you have, how they're expressed. How you express the values, how you express meaning. A simple example of a cultural difference is the way that Americans and Indians serve food. So if I'm in an American's home, American devotee home, and I'm a guest, and they'll say, would you like another chapati? If I say no thanks, they move on. And if I'm in an Indian's home, and first of all, they may not even ask me if I want another chapati. They may just put one on my plate. And if they ask me and I say no thanks, they'll pressure me. Or as they say in Britain, they'll pressurize me. They'll say, oh, are you sure? Wouldn't you like to have another one? You haven't had enough. Only one? And they'll go on like that for at least a minute. And they may even ask me several times. So in America, to be pressured when you said no is considered rude. It's considered a lack of respect. I know how many chapatis I can eat. But in India, not asking again is considered to be rude. So the very same behavior in one culture is seen as respectful and one culture is seen as rude. In India, it's respectful to give people something that they say they didn't want. Please close that door to the temple room. And they'll... Hey kids, close the door after you go in.
Okay.
This is going to be interesting. So that's an example of how culture is the external form of meaning. It's the behaviors that form that make the form of meaning. So in other words, we can say, I value respect. But what form does respect take? That depends on the culture. And it may take opposite forms in different cultures. So we can talk about universal values. They found in research that universal values are purity, respect for authority, fairness, community or loyalty, and not doing harm to others. But how those manifest change from culture to culture. So what are the values of a society? What has what meaning in society? And how does that manifest? Not just the abstract terms that one talks about. So that's what we mean by culture. Okay, now we're going to look at the fact that every religion, and let's look at Vaishnavism as a religion. I don't generally like to do that, but I think for the sake of this discussion, that would be helpful. Let's say that every religion, when you go in the temple room, please close the door behind you. Thank you. That every religion has a culture that's native to it, just like every human being has their native country where they were born. So every religion has its native culture. And that culture is either where the religion was born or where the religion flourished. For example, although Christianity was born in the Middle East, it didn't flourish there, it flourished in Europe. Therefore, European culture is the culture that's native to Christianity. And Buddhism was born in India, but it really flourished in Tibet and China and Thailand. So those are the cultures that are native to Buddhism. So that's our idea of a native culture. So like Islam and Vaishnavism, their cultures are the ones where they were born, and religions like Christianity and Buddhism, their native cultures are the cultures where they flourished. Is that clear? The function of a native culture is that, again, culture is the embodiment of the meaning and values of a society. So when you have a culture that's native to a religion, that culture embodies the values and the meaning of that religion. And it supports that religion. You can think of it like the body and the soul. You know, the soul is animating the body, and the body is expressing the desires of the soul. So the religion is animating the culture, and the culture is expressing the meaning and the values of that religion. And one way you can see that please close the door. I wish they'd just have a really quiet kirtan. Even with the door closed. They were already told once. Maybe you could tell them again, like really, 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 really quiet, because otherwise I'm going to kill my voice trying to compete with them. Actually, Jayashree, would you be willing to ask them to take the kirtan down to 1/10 the volume? Because otherwise we can't speak without a mic.
I can try.
They were asked once already. What? Maybe I'll go ask them. Will you guys tolerate that I just... All right. Where was I? Okay, I was talking about native cultures.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to give an example. Just like, for example, in Europe, Sundays are off. Christmas is off. It's a holiday. If you want to be a Christian in Europe, you have support from the culture to be a Christian. You will not find here in America that Ekadasi is a day off. And even in India, it's a lot easier to find a vegetarian restaurant, for example, in India. It's a lot more accepted if you say that you're vegetarian. So when you're with the culture that's native to your religion, you get more support from the culture. And now we want to look at three main points about the culture that's native to the practice of Vaishnavism. And I'd like you to think a minute about the examples that I gave. I gave the example of Europe and Christianity, of places like Thailand and Tibet and Buddhism, right, of Islam in the Middle East. What is the culture that's native to the practice of Vaishnavism?
Vaishnavism?
Let's just say Vaishnavism in general. What culture is native?
Vedic culture.
Vedic culture. What's different
about the relationship between Vedic culture and being a Vaishnava, and European culture and being a Christian, or all the other examples that I gave. What's unique about the relationship between the practice of being a Vaishnava and Vedic culture? Well, each of those are native, but we have a relationship with our native culture that they don't have. Well, that's true.
We consider that we gave, we're the source of Vedic culture.
Yes.
Not the other way around.
Yes, exactly. We could say that it was almost like Vedic culture and Vaishnava religion, you know, the eternal religion, they exist simultaneously, and they're both coming from God. Middle Eastern culture, although it's the native culture of Islam, Middle Eastern culture itself didn't come from Muhammad. And although Christianity is, Europe is the place that Christianity flourished, European culture didn't come from Jesus. Tibetan culture didn't come from Buddha. It was more circumstantial. The religion happened to come into being or flourish in a particular culture, so that culture happened to be native to that religion, and the culture and the religion grew together. In our case, Vedic culture and the practice of Vaishnavism both come from God. And they're designed, in other words, they're designed to support each other. So all native cultures support the religion that's native to it. But our native culture particularly supports our religious practice. So we have a very special bond with our native culture. Now obviously the reason I'm bringing this in is if we could live in our native culture, would there be any stigma? No, there'd be no stigma. If the world was in Vedic culture, there would be no stigma for being a devotee of Krishna. It would be a natural part of the culture. All right. Now we have two other interesting things about our native culture. The first thing is, what is Vedic culture? Do we really know what Vedic culture is? Well, yes. But do I know? Again, culture is the external form of values and meaning in the society. Do I really know what that is? We argue in ISKCON about how to speak to each other. What terms to use to speak to. Well, that's Vedic. No, that's not Vedic. That's a pretty small thing. How do I speak to it? Do I call you a Prabhu or a Prabhi or a Mataji or a mother or what do I call you? That means we don't know. There isn't a consensus about what is the Vedic form of address. And there are people who debate. Like, for example, this particular way of wearing a sari is modern. This isn't an ancient way of wearing a sari. If you look at all the old carvings and paintings, there's about 2,000 ways of wearing a sari, but this isn't one of them. So we often debate about what's Vedic. I mean, there are people who are saying, well, some of the food we now say is Vedic didn't exist in India and it wasn't even grown at that time, and how could that actually be Vedic? Have you heard any of these discussions? So one problem we have, and for those who came in late, I'm going to apologize. This was going to be projected, so I have to keep looking. My notes are here. Sorry, I don't usually do things that way. So one of our problems is we're not sure what Vedic culture is, and that's a pretty big problem. Another problem is, does Vedic culture exist anywhere? Is there anywhere in the world that we can really say, okay, there's Vedic culture? No. Okay, what about Indian? Is Indian culture native for being a Vaishnava? In some ways, yes, in some ways, no. Right, there's many things going on in India today that are opposed to the practice of Vaishnavas. I mean, some things are favorable, especially if you're in a place like Vrindavan, like here in Tirumala. But if you're in Bombay, Mumbai, you don't have that much support from the culture. You definitely have more support than you have here. But India doesn't really represent anything that's our native culture. We don't really have a place that's fully our native culture. All right, now that we've looked at native cultures, we're going to look at alien cultures. I want to make the point, and this is going to be very, very important when considering about having the stigma of being a religious person, is that any religion that claims to be universal must contact alien cultures. Any religion that claims to be universal must contact alien cultures, because you're preaching and you're bringing in people from other cultures. Can any of you think of a religion that does not claim to be universal? Judaism. Very good example. So, for example, the Orthodox Jews, they don't mix so much with the outside cultures. They have their own little cultural enclaves. They don't encourage people to convert. They strongly discourage you if you try to convert, and they certainly don't preach. What's another example?
Zoroastrianism, Parsis in India.
Oh my God, I'm not familiar, but are they similar?
They are similar.
And then another example I thought was the Amish, where the culture and the religion are like this. Right? They're keeping their native culture completely. They don't want to interact at all with alien cultures. They don't want to bring in people from alien cultures, and they don't want to go out to alien cultures. They're keeping a firm bond between their religion and their native culture. I hope those examples help clarify things. All right, with alien cultures, there's basically three alien cultures that we're facing. We have to face alien cultures as devotees of Krishna because we're claiming that we have a universal religion. We're claiming that we're following Sanatana Dharma. We're not following an ethnic religion. Like the Jews, you know, you're born Jewish. You're born Amish. It doesn't matter if you're an atheist. If you have a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. It's not claiming to be Sanatana Dharma. We're claiming to be Sanatana Dharma. So we're contacting three kinds of alien cultures. One kind of alien culture we're contacting is a culture that's native to other religions. Local cultures that are native to other religions. Like here in America, this culture is native to Christianity. If you're in Thailand, you're contacting a culture that's native to Buddhism. So hold that thought, because we're going to look at that a little later. Then we're also contacting two kinds of global secular culture that are alien to all religions, which is why the stigma is not only on us, but it's also on Christians and on Muslims and on Jews and anybody who claims to be more than nominally religious. Now, this is a little technical, but there's two kinds of global secular cultures. One which is called positivism, and one which is called post-positivism, or modernism and post-modernism. Modernism or positivism states that everything can be understood empirically through science, that there is some kind of absolute objective truth which we can understand through our senses and our mind, which Srila Prabhupada preaches against quite a lot. So that's one kind of global secular culture. And it's saying there isn't anything mystical, everything is objective, everything is based on sense perception and logic, and therefore religion is out of the picture, because religion depends on something beyond just the senses and logic, and it's not something that's objective fact for everybody. Then there's another kind of global secular culture, which is called post-positivism or post-modernism. They're bringing in the screen. Does this mean the power may go on?
Well, we are ready.
Okay, thank you. So postmodernism or post-positivism says there's no objective truth. And even if there is an objective truth, none of us are able to access this with the senses and the mind. So post-positivism or postmodernism agrees with our contention that empiric knowledge will not give you the absolute truth. But they say whatever you believe is okay. They're the yatamatatapa. Every culture is equally valuable. Every religion is equally valuable. But they therefore don't like anyone who's preaching an absolute. So they don't like the scientists who are preaching an absolute, but they don't like religionists who are preaching an absolute. Of course, they're also preaching an absolute. They're saying everything is absolutely relative. Okay, I'm not going to try to defeat either positivism or post-positivism in this seminar, but just to give you an idea, these are the two kinds of secular thought, of non-religious thought, that have created an alien culture to all religions in the world today. And they're not exactly the same kind of thinking, although they coexist within the society. So one says, the absolute truth is that everything is relative. The absolute truth is that there's no absolute truth, and anyone who claims to have an absolute truth doesn't have any, and everything is equally valid. And another kind of global secular culture says there is an absolute objective truth, and it can be understood through science, and it cannot be understood through mysticism. Mysticism is unreal. So those are the three kinds of alien cultures that we're in contact with, and that we have to be in contact with because we are preaching a universal religion. So here we are, we're in alien cultures. Now again, if you're in an alien culture, who's the alien? You are, right? Again, as I said earlier, people from Mars come here, they're the aliens. So if I'm living in an alien culture, I'm the alien. I'm the other. Therefore, there's this stigma. Why are you different? Oh, I just thought of a really funny story. We used to have mice in our house in Detroit. So we would usually catch them humanely and then put them outside. But in the wintertime, I didn't want to put them outside because I figured they would die. We put them out in the snow. So being a, you know, a sentimental woman, I went to my husband and said, oh, my dear Prabhu, instead of putting the mice outside, why don't we buy a cage and we can trap the mice and we'll put all the mice in the cage and when it gets to be spring, we'll put them outside. So that's what we did. And we had a whole cage full of mice in our house, which was also a gurukula, so the children were very entertained by all the mice. So all the mice that we caught were from the ground floor, which was where the kitchen is, which is reasonable that the mice would mostly go in the kitchen. Well, one day, my husband caught a little baby mouse on the stairs, about two-thirds of the way up the stairs. So he took this baby mouse and he put it in the cage with the other mice. And as soon as he did that, the mice had two reactions. The female mice covered up the baby with straw, and the male mice attacked the baby and killed it. And what we realized that happened is we must have gotten a baby from another tribe. Must have been like the upstairs tribe. At which point I became disgusted with mice and put them all out in the snow. But my point is that we tend to want to either cover up or attack anybody who's different. Anyone who's an other. So this is why we're running into this stigma. Now these two global secular cultures are affecting all religions in the world, and they're affecting all religious people, even if you live in a very remote area. So even if you're in a Himalayan village, or you're in, you know, Bandiravan in Vrindavan, you're still going to be affected by these global secular cultures. They become pervading. There's practically speaking, no place you can go on the planet anymore where you can escape the influence of this global secular culture. And primarily it's spread through the
media,
which is everywhere. I mean, some of you may have seen the children's books that we're working on. And when we were starting to do the reading books, I spent a lot of time looking at commercial books to teach children how to read. And there's four parts, and maybe some of you read this in my article on evolution and back to Godhead. There's four parts to any curriculum. One is what's called the planned curriculum, the stated curriculum. This is what we say we're teaching. Another is what's actually taught, which usually isn't exactly the same. Then there's what's called the hidden curriculum, and finally there's what's called the null curriculum. And the two most powerful ways of teaching are through the hidden curriculum and the null curriculum. The planned curriculum is meaningless. Right? It's only what's actually taught that has meaning, not what you say you're going to teach. The hidden curriculum is what's taught through the norms, the values, the rules, the dress, the pictures that are used. If you look, as I said, I was looking through all these children's reading books, and I was seeing that all of the families in all of the books lived in middle-class suburbia. It didn't matter what the publisher was, or if they were trying to do, you know, multicultural. Multicultural just meant the people had a little different color skin. But they were living the exact same lives. They were pretty much dressing the same way. They were living in the same kind of place. They were eating the same kind of food. They had the same kind of house. And all the stories were of this sort of family. And I also noticed that in none of the books was there any religion. None of the families in any of the books ever prayed or went to a place of worship. If they did observe some religious holiday, they observed it in a non-religious way. Religion was just absent from these books. So that's the hidden and the no curriculum. No curriculum is what you don't talk about. We don't talk about religion. It's just not there. The hidden curriculum is how people are portrayed. Or if you look at books here in America from, say, the 1940s and 50s and 60s, all of the children in the books are going to be white with blonde hair and blue eyes and Anglo-Saxon names. They're also all going to live in suburbia. Some of them will live on farms, which you don't see so much in modern books. So again, that was a hidden curriculum. It was saying, this is the only normal. This is the only socially accepted. And when I went to school, something that was in the no curriculum was the great advancements of ancient civilization, for example. The monuments in South America that nobody can explain how they were built. Another thing that was in the no curriculum is all of the psychic abilities that people have, the paranormal experiences. That's just not in the curriculum. And that forms people's idea much more than what's openly taught. So in a similar way, the local alien cultures who are supporting their own native religions and the global secular cultures, they're giving out hidden messages about what's normal. And they're not talking about very strictly religious people, either at all or only in pejorative terms. Like, what are the kind of terms used to describe very religious people? Fanatic? Zealots? Brainwashed? Extremists? Nothing better to do. So that's a kind of hidden curriculum where you're using only pejorative words. And that's going everywhere.
So therefore, even if you're Indian trying to practice Krishna consciousness in India, which is where we were already talking about the fact that India is not a totally native culture to the practice of Vaishnava religion, but you're still being affected by the global secular culture. And we see this in our temples in India. We have, we have problems in Mayapur and in Vrindavan, even in the Dham, with the children, getting outside movies and being influenced by this concept that the only normal is non-religious. So we're in a situation where we have to contact alien cultures because we're preaching mission. We're preaching Sanatana Dharma. Plus, everybody's got to contact alien cultures. Even the Amish and the Orthodox Jews are having to contact alien cultures because of the global secular culture. So now we're coming to the crux of the matter. And this next thing that I'm going to present, I will warn you that it may shake you a little bit. It may shake some of your paradigms and bring you into some deeper thinking. So if you don't like that, I wouldn't be offended if you left me. So how are we going to deal with alien cultures? I have these really nice PowerPoints for you guys. I'm really sorry. I sure hope the power is on by tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be swimming in Krishna Leela, and I have to... Anyway. Sorry, Krishna. All right. There are basically three ways of dealing with an alien culture. Each of these have their good points and their bad points. You may think that one of them is superior to another. They each have their good points and their bad points. And what we're going to end with is really looking personally. What do I choose and what will I get and what do I have to give up? So the exclusive view is the culture of the religion's origin is the only one that can permit authentic expressions of its doctrines and values. The culture of the religion's origin is the only one that can permit authentic expressions of its doctrines and values. So So the exclusive view says the only way, remember what culture is? Culture is a way of expressing the values and the meaning that you have. That's what culture is. So naturally, the native culture is going to give the most authentic expression of your values and meaning. By definition, it must. But the exclusive view says the native culture is the only culture that can give an authentic expression of the religion's meaning and values. That it's impossible to authentically express your spiritual ideals through the medium of any other culture. Do you have some idea of what this looks like? Do you get some sense of what that looks like and feels like? Can you give me a description of a Hare Krishna devotee who has an exclusive view towards alien cultures? What kind of life would that person live? Everyone else is a demon, okay.
You know, I wear dhoti kurtam in my office and we get the light because that's the only way to become.
Yes, definitely. I go to work, I have to go to work with dhoti kurtam and so on.
Ours is the only authentic, because we come in the parampara and the disciplic succession, and everyone else is like.
Yes, but that's a little different. I think you were not here at the beginning. So we're talking about culture. We're differentiating between our spirituality and our culture. Yes?
I would say even within ISKCON, we have certain devotees that believe that only the Indian presentation of Krishna consciousness is correct, and that anything that's influenced by any type of Western thought or Western accommodation is...
Yes, even using the word accommodation is interesting. Your use of the word accommodation is a hidden curriculum. Is that clear? Okay. I'll make a disclaimer that of these three, I have more of a tendency to be this. And when I studied this, I realized that my own tendency is to take this view. And looking at this caused me to question whether or not that was necessarily the best thing to do in all circumstances. So I'll just put that out on the table. So as someone who takes an exclusive view, they're not going to eat pizza. They're not going to wear blue jeans. They're not going to listen to devotional music with a guitar. Or they're going to think that all of that, that those are not authentic expressions of the spirituality. Okay, the next one we're going to look... Oh, well, which way should I do this? Maybe I'll go back and forth. Okay, a relativistic point of view says all elements... I'm going to just back up a little bit for those of you who came in late, which I don't usually do, but I'm just going to do that. We're looking at being stigmatized for being a religious person, and we're looking at that in terms of culture, that every religion has a culture that's native to it, and that all other cultures are alien. We looked at three kinds of alien culture. One is local cultures that are native to other religions, like Thailand is native to Buddhism, Europe is native to Christianity, and we looked at two kinds of global secular cultures. And that the reason we're stigmatized is that we're trying to function in alien cultures. And now we're looking at three ways of dealing with alien cultures. Okay, exclusive says that my native culture, and you remember the problems with Vaishnavism's native culture. You all remember that, right? That we had some problems with even defining what is our native culture and even finding where it exists. Now people who are strongly exclusive are trying to recreate that kind of culture. Okay. The relativistic view is they say all elements of any culture are equally valid. Does this sound a little bit like the global secular post-positivism? All elements of any culture are equally valid and can support our religion without care for the inner meaning and coherence of the culture. All elements of any culture are equally valid and can support our religion without care for the inner meaning and coherence of the culture. Now remember that every culture on the planet is native to some religion, especially if you want to take religion as something that gives meaning and purpose to life, not necessarily some idea about God. But every culture on the planet is native to some religion. So every culture on the planet is an external manifestation of some meaning and values. So the relativistic view says we're going to ignore the meaning and the values that are behind the cultural expressions of the alien culture. And we are going to be able to express our values and our meaning through anything in that, in whatever culture that we're in. How would a devotee who has a relative... Now, first of all, you hardly ever find people who are extremes of these type, although I have met. I will say we have members in ISKCON who are extremes of each of these type, but they're unusual. Someone who has this particular point of view, how would they behave? Yes?
They would be accepting with any other culture and willing to, like, not compromise, but willing to make adjustments. Like,
the word compromise is a pejorative word.
Yeah.
Okay. So what sort of things would they do? We want to look at this neutrally right now. Yes?
As opposed to the example of always wearing a dhoti and a sari in work, like never refusing to ever wear a dhoti or a sari because it's Indian as opposed to...
Okay, they might never wear dhoti or sari, or they might wear sometimes and not wear other times, but they would think that it doesn't matter. Right. They would say it doesn't matter. They could say, I'm equally Krishna conscious, whether I'm wearing blue jeans or whether I'm wearing dhoti, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, some of these people might wear blue jeans sometimes, but they'd feel really bad about it. And they'd say, well, as soon as I'm blue jeans, I can't really be a devotee. I can't really, because they'd say only our own native culture is the authentic way to express the meaning and values of culture. So, yeah, these people would be willing to adopt whatever was around them in the alien culture and not feeling that there was any difference. Okay, we're going to look at... The inclusive or dialogic view is every culture and society met in space and time is a key to probe into deeper and universal dimensions of our own faith and mission. Every culture and society met in space and time is a key to probe into deeper and universal dimensions of our own faith and mission. So the people who have a dialogic view, they look at the culture and say, okay, this alien culture that I'm in, it's connected with some meaning, with some philosophy of life. And there are things in that culture that are going to be the same as universal truths in my culture. So there are going to be things in that alien culture that do allow for authentic expressions of my own spirituality, and there are things that are not. And it's called dialogic because there's a give and take. The view here is that I'm going to give some things to the alien culture, and I'm going to take in some things from the alien culture. So this is... It's almost an aggressive stance. I keep the alien culture at a distance. I form my own wall. My only authentic expression of my spirituality is within my own culture. Anything else is inauthentic. Here, anything can be authentic. Doesn't matter. Culture becomes irrelevant. And here, I'm carefully considering what I can take in and what I can't. Remember I said there's pros and cons for each of these, right?
Okay, a question here.
Yes. Right now we're just defining.
Yeah.
Yes.
A good example of, I should say, dialogy could be the spread of Christianity throughout the world, and the Christianity into different cultures, and adapt itself to meet the requirements of the local culture. Would that be a good example for that?
Yes, as I said, these definitions come from a term called enculturalization, which was developed by the Catholic Church in their missionary work. So that's where this conceptual framework comes from. This conceptual framework also applies... And I'm not going to get into that now. I'm going to present this seminar from a different angle in Italy in mid-July, Krishna willing. And there we're also going to look at organizational structure, that organizations can also be what's called closed, porous, or flexible. And that we could look at ISKCON's history in terms of that as well. But yeah, this definitely, we're not just talking about Krishna consciousness. We're talking about any religion that goes out of its native culture and interacts with alien cultures. But of course, when those ideas were developed for Catholicism, the global secular culture didn't exist. And now, because we have two forms of the global secular culture, as I say, nobody can avoid dealing with alien cultures. All right, we're going to look at pros and cons. Thank you. So the advantage of this is you get a really strong sense of identity. I am a Hare Krishna devotee. I am a member of ISKCON. You know, I'm a devotee of Krishna. I'm a follower of Srila Prabhupada. You have a strong sense of personal identity, and you have a strong sense of community identity, which gives you a lot of strength. You also get, if you're able to form your own little enclave of Vedic culture, or whatever you feel is close to Vedic culture, then you also get support from your culture. You know, like the Amish have their own little communities, and the Orthodox Jews have their own little communities. And there are many places in the world where devotees have formed their own little communities. Okay, in this community, you know, and here in New Vrindavan is an example of it. In this community, we're going to follow norms of Vedic culture. So in our community, you're not stigmatized for being a religious person. So you have that, those are the strong positives. Now, of course, as soon as you go out of your community, you're in trouble. Right? And one of the problems is you can get what's kind of called a ghetto mentality. You form your own ghetto. You form your own enclave, and you don't want to interact with the outside world. Now remember, as a preacher of Sanatana Dharma, we claim to be practicing Sanatana Dharma, and as preachers, we must contact alien cultures. There's no option for us of staying in our enclave. So when we contact alien cultures, there's several ways of doing that. One is you can become schizophrenic. I had a really cute visual for this one. Anyway, one, you can become schizophrenic. So when you're in your own culture, you behave like that, and when you go in the alien cultures, you behave like that. The problem with being exclusive is you haven't found any way to be both a member of the alien culture and a practitioner of your own religion. You can be one or the other, but you can't be both. Philosophically, this is saying you can't be both. You can't function in the alien culture and be an authentic devotee. That's what this philosophy is saying. It's impossible. You can be a devotee, but you can't be an authentic devotee. You can't be the real thing. So a person then can't integrate. It's impossible. They can't integrate their life. They can't balance their life. They just can't do it. Here I have to pretend like I'm part of the alien culture, and here I have to, then here I can be a devotee. And it forces people, and this is particularly applicable to our children, if they're raised with an exclusive point of view, and you see this with the Amish, and you see this with the Orthodox Jews, it forces people to choose. Because it's saying you can't have both. And having both is impossible. So you have to choose that either I'm fully a devotee and I fully live within the culture, or I live like people in the alien culture. I've no way to integrate them. Well, another thing that happens is one or the other can become irrelevant to members. Either the alien culture can become irrelevant, and people with an exclusive point of view would say, well, what's wrong with that? Or your spiritual identity would become irrelevant if you try to work outside. Okay? So those are the pros and the cons. You with me? Okay. Right? And something to consider about having an exclusive, aggressive mentality in regard to alien cultures that are native to other religions is if one has this mentality towards not just the global secular culture, which is alien to all religions, but if one has this mentality towards local cultures, because local cultures are expressions of other religions, the other religions will then see that you have an aggressive stance towards them. And you see this, like you're talking about Catholic missionaries. We've seen missionaries who tried to strip local people of their culture. Because again, the native culture and the religion are intertwined. So they'll go into another culture and they'll not only try to change their spiritual values, but they'll try to totally change all of their culture. And often the people feel violated. This is happening right now with Christians in India. That there are Christians in India that are very aggressively making Christian converts, and they're trying to not only change people's views about what is the absolute truth and what's my process of spiritual life, they're also trying to totally change people's culture. And a lot of the protests against the behavior of these Christian missionaries is not on the basis of philosophy or spirituality, but on the basis of cultural conquest. So if we're also doing that, then the people of that alien culture, the people who have the religion of that alien culture, will also feel that we're doing something called religious vandalism. Okay, so that's looking at exclusive. Now we're going to look at relativistic, synchronistic. So again, this is thinking all elements of any culture are a fine expression for my spiritual life. I don't make any distinction. So on the positive is you can fully integrate into the alien culture. I mean, we see here in America, there's many Christians who fully integrate into the global secular culture. You cannot tell at all by looking at their life that they're religious people. They just look and act and dress and talk and eat like everybody else, correct? Right? You can fully integrate. You almost lose your stigma. Stigma's basically gone because you're not an alien anymore. You've adopted the alien culture. Right? Of course, the downside is you can lose your spiritual identity. Because culture is the expression of your spiritual values. If you start taking the expression of other values and other meanings, it can affect your philosophy. It can affect your identity. You no longer know who you are anymore. And you lose the support of your culture. You're then in a culture that doesn't support your values and doesn't support your meaning. Right? And we certainly see this happen. Right? We've seen all these things happen. Right? We've seen an exclusive point of view lead to people who say, well, I just can't be a devotee outside. I can't be a real devotee. Just the other day, I had someone say to me in London, say, well, I don't know if ever in my life I can do full-time service. Well, what do you mean by full-time service? I mean living in the temple full-time, wearing a sari, and just going on Sankirtan. I said, well, why can't you do full-time service outside? So she was reacting to an exclusive point of view. I have to choose either or. And then we also see people who say, well, you know, I'll just merge with the society, and they end up losing themselves. They end up saying, well, what happened to my Krishna consciousness? So you might say, well, you might think this one is the ideal. Again, I have the disclaimer that if I'm anywhere on this scale, I'm somewhere probably around here for my own self. Looking here at the pros and cons, so the benefits of this is you would have open and profound dialogue between our own spirituality and the various alien cultures. There'd also be a mutual participation and a synthesis where, again, we'd be giving to the alien cultures and they'd also be giving to us. And there'd be flexibility. You'd have enough flexibility that you can move in all circles. That's kind of the ideal of it, that I can both, you know, be with the devotees and really be a devotee and be comfortable, and I can also be out in the alien culture and be comfortable. Now, you wouldn't completely lose your stigma because you'd be very careful about what you're getting from the alien cultures. If it could be fully accomplished, the stigma would almost disappear. Now, in order for dialogic to work, dialogue means two. In order for dialogue to work, the people in the alien culture would have to agree to dialogue with you. So that's one downside. You can't just say, well, I'm going to just dialogue with the culture. Then it becomes relativistic. Dialogue means that there's some back and forth going on. And also, I put this as a positive, but it's also a negative. It requires a lot of deep thought. It's not easy. It's easy to say the only authentic way of expressing Krishna consciousness is to wear a sari. That's an easy thing to say. Or it's easy to say, I can authentically express Krishna consciousness no matter what I wear. But it's much more difficult to say, now, what kind of clothes do allow me to authentically express Krishna consciousness? It takes a lot more thought. It takes a lot more care. It takes a lot more talking with other people. It takes a lot more research. It takes a lot more consideration. It's not something simple. It's not something straightforward. And there may be a lot of dissension and argument about it. You may have one idea about what kind of an acceptable synthesis could go on, and I might have another one. And when it comes to us as a society, it's very unlikely that we're all going to agree about that. So we could say that a dialogic point of view, the ideal of a dialogic point of view, would be a mutually enriching critical correlation between religious faith and societal culture that paves the way for a creative integration of the two. Again, this is the ideal of the dialogic. A mutually enriching critical correlation between religious faith and societal culture that paves the way for a creative integration of the two. Now you can see that people who hold these views will have very different ideas as to what would be the ideal, the Hare Krishna's take over the world scenario. These people, the Hare Krishna take over the world, everybody lives on farms and plows with oxen, everyone wears dhotis and saris, and everybody eats pakoras. You know, with these people taking over the world means in China they're still eating sticky rice. You ever been to China? Half the preps are sticky rice. You have something, you think, oh, halva. No, it's sticky rice. Oh, cake. No, it's sticky rice. Oh, wow, it looks like a samosa. No, it's sticky rice. So relativistic people are still eating sticky rice. They're still, you know, doing whatever they're doing, but they're adding the chanting of the Hare Krishna. They're adding offering their food. They're adding the reading of Srila Prabhupada's books. But this is an interesting thing. What would this look like? You know, it would be kind of a some sort of a mixture where some elements of various cultures were retained in a worldwide society and were changed. We'd really have to have a discussion. What kind of a Krishna conscious world would this look like with the dialogic point of view? I mean, the challenge of for many of us... Oh, I didn't give you examples of all these, did I? Just, I'm going to go back for a minute. If it was on the board, it would have been naturally there. Okay. I'm sorry, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. I'm going to give you three examples of contact with alien cultures. So one is like French devotees in Mayapur. Right, where you're in the area of a native culture, but people from an alien culture. Then you have Indian devotees in London. So people who are born in the native culture, living in an area of an alien culture. And then American devotees in America. Right? So you're in your native culture, but you're in a culture that's alien to your religion. Now, for those of us, which is probably... Even those of you who are Indian-bodied, I'm not sure where you were born and brought up, which would change the equation here. But when you're born and brought up in a culture that's alien to Krishna consciousness, and you're living in a culture that's alien to Krishna consciousness, the challenge is to how to integrate your religious faith, which has a foreign origin and is closely bound to an alien culture, into your own indigenous cultural tradition. And I wish this was up on the board. I'll say that a couple more times. Thank you for your patience. How to integrate our religious faith, which has a foreign origin and is closely bound to an alien culture, into our own indigenous cultural tradition. How to integrate our religious faith, which has a foreign origin and is closely bound to an alien culture, with our own indigenous cultural tradition. All right, now, one could ask, and I'm sure some of you would ask, what did Prabhupada want? Which was Prabhupada's view? You can find support for all three. I'd say you'll probably find a lot more support for these two than for this. But you certainly find a lot of support for either of these. You find a little bit of support for this. It took me quite a while to find any support for this. All right, as far as the exclusive aggressive... How would you say is evidence that Prabhupada wanted us to have an exclusive, aggressive view towards alien cultures?
He talked about farm communities.
Farm communities? What else? Yes?
Describe the modern education schools as in the slaughterhouses.
Slaughterhouses, okay.
You mean vegetarian?
Maybe. I don't know about being vegetarian, but I'd say wanting to eat traditional foods. Which, by the way, has gone way down in ISKCON since Prabhupada left. I didn't see any yeast bread in ISKCON until 1978. So when Prabhupada was here, we pretty much, not entirely, but almost entirely, we ate only very traditional foods. I mean, with the exception of cakes and cookies, I think. Yeah?
Your Prabhupada talked a lot about hotels and cinema houses.
Yes. Does Prabhupada talk a lot about Vedic culture and reestablishing Vedic culture? A lot, yeah.
Varnashram
Dharma.
Stress
that. I mean, Prabhupada definitely liked us to wear these kind of clothes. He liked us to eat the certain cultural food. Yes?
I was having a conversation with Prabhupada, made a comment. If a man disciple is from here, then he is no longer my disciple. Prabhupada was so insistent that his disciples were shaved up.
Or have very short hair.
Yeah, that if someone drew their hair off, they would say, well, then he's no longer my son.
Well, of course, that's an interesting point, because if you look at our culture, our cultural background does not dictate men with shaved head or short hair. Because if you look at Bhagavatam and you look at Vaishnav culture, men also could have matted hair and beards. Like Bhagavatam, it says the brahmachari can have either matted hair or shaved head. And Prabhupada specifically wanted not to use matted hair because he didn't want us associated with hippies. So I see that as not only that Prabhupada wanted us to have an authentic expression of the culture, but Prabhupada was actually looking there at a time, place, and circumstance that I'm going to pick this particular expression of the culture because of this particular circumstance. Because there are other authentic expressions of the culture.
He made an exclusive accommodation.
Yes. Yes, he made an accommodation within the exclusive. I mean, just like when my husband and I became vanaprastas, you know, I really had to think about, okay, how do I dress? I had one person recently chastise me. She said, you can't wear white with a border and a bindi. And I said, why not? She said, that's just not allowed. And I'm not allowed where? It turns out it's not allowed in her part of India. And I said, well, you know, in South India, even the married women wear white with border. But, you know, Bhagavatam said, according to Bhagavatam, I should wear clothes that are old and torn, and I should have matted hair. I thought about it. So, no, Prabhupada didn't have us do 100% something that was our exclusive culture. Prabhupada did make some adjustments. I don't think Srila Prabhupada would be pleased if I went in front of him with old torn clothes and dreadlocks. Yes. Okay. The instruments we use. Prabhupada tended to favor the traditional instruments. All right, so let's look at, we can give many examples. I have, as for relativistic, as I say, I really had to dig for some support for this. I found these quotes. In our Krishna consciousness movement, the tactic of dressing oneself like an ordinary karmi is necessary because everyone in the demoniac kingdom is against the Vaishnava teachings. The preachers of Krishna consciousness must go forward in their Vaishnava dress or any other dress, he said. So this any other dress is a relativistic perspective for the purpose of preaching. We don't say that you don't advance in material education. You advance, that was from a purport. You advance, but at the same time, you become Krishna conscious. That is our propaganda. We don't say you don't. You do not manufacture a motor car, or you do not manufacture these so many machines. We don't say. But we say, all right, you have manufactured this machine, employed in Krishna's service. That is our proposal. We don't say stop it. That is a relativistic point. So Prabhupada definitely preached like that sometimes. That I'm not saying change the culture. I'm saying just add Krishna consciousness. Okay, as far as support for dialogic, what I found is the greatest support for dialogic is the Bhaktivedanta Institute. So Prabhupada's idea with the Bhaktivedanta Institute is you're having a marriage of Western science with Krishna conscious philosophy. He wanted Krishna conscious philosophy expressed in the terms of Western science. So that is a dialogic perspective. And he wanted our devotee scientists to dialogue with Western scientists. Another example I can think of, which I really thought about deeply in the past few years and kind of changed my own life, my own thinking a bit, is the concept of the blind man and the lame man. Sorry, my throat's a little without the mic. At least the kirtan's gone a little softer. The Prabhupada said the blind man and the lame man. Prabhupada didn't say everything in India is great. Let's just take on Indian culture. I mean, sometimes I hear devotees saying like that. Let's just do whatever the Indians do. You know, personally, I don't think that every single thing that goes on in India is favorable to Krishna consciousness. He said, India can see, but it can't walk, and the West can walk, but it can't see. So we should work together. That is definitely a dialogic perspective. All right, so when dealing with our own, again, I had some cool graphics here. When dealing with our own lives and how to avoid this, it's painful to deal with the stigma of being a religious person outside society. Well, I come to the conclusion that there's no question of life without tapasya. And I have a couple nice quotes from Krishna himself talking to Lord Brahma. I create this cosmos by penance. I maintain it by the same energy. I withdraw it all by the same energy. Therefore, the potential power is penance only. And then from the Gita, the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. That basically, whatever we want, we have to pay a price. There's nothing free. What life is about is you decide what you want to enjoy, how you want to enjoy, and then you pay the requisite price. I mean, I talk about this a lot in terms of the ashrams. You know, you want to enjoy security. You want to enjoy, you know, having your own money, having your own house, the association of the opposite sex. So then what's the sacrifice? You have to work. You have to maintain a house. You have to put up with the idiosyncrasies of the opposite sex. You have to raise children. And if you want the pleasures of freedom and simplicity, then you have to do the austerities of not having a job, the austerities of not having even emotional connection with the opposite sex. Now, the austerities and the pleasure go together. What many people try to do in modern society is take the pleasure from everywhere and the sacrifice from nowhere. Let me get all the pleasures of the grahastha ashram and all the pleasures of the renounced ashram and not do the sacrifices for either. That's very typical. So each of these have, again, benefits and sacrifices. They each have benefits and sacrifices. My suggestion is that as individuals, we think about these things consciously and deliberately and explicitly and say, what do I want to get? What benefits are important to me as an individual? And what am I willing to pay for it? And this is true not only for us, but it's especially important when talking about how we're going to educate our children. And I think especially as our children grow up, we should discuss with them what are the different ways of dealing with alien cultures and what are the prices of each? What are the benefits and what are the prices? But there's no question of doing something without paying a price. It's impossible. You can't. You can't say, okay, I'm just going to have everything and I'm not going to do any sort of sacrifice. Even if we wanted to create a global Vedic culture, and first of all, we'd have to decide what Vedic culture is, then that would be a sacrifice to create it. To create a farm community, to create some kind of an enclosure, to create some way where everybody could get all their needs met within the community. And then again, we'd have to figure out how to preach and how to bring in new members. Because the societies that have enclosed cultures like that are terrible at bringing in new members from the alien culture. If we really want to have a dialogic dealings with the alien cultures, we have to become thoughtful. We have to become discerning. We have to take the time. If we want the support of an exclusive relationship, then we've got to put up with being stigmatized. Right? If we want the benefit of not being stigmatized, then we have to put up with the fact that there's not much support for our spiritual life. So these are the real questions we have to ask ourselves. It's interesting, I used to teach this seminar quite differently. And there I went through a series of suggestions, such as, you know, try to be friendly with the people at work and gradually have them get to know you as a nice person. And then at a certain point, you can kind of reveal to them that you're a devotee. And I think those things are valid. I've done them myself. When I was working at my internship for my graduate degree, and there was no way I could let anybody know I was a devotee, although the other woman who worked in my office knew because she was in the same university. But toward the end of the very end of my work there, as in the last 2 weeks, when I graduated, my son also graduated, and we got in the newspapers. You know, mother, son graduate together. And it mentioned that we were Hare Krishnas. So all of a sudden, I had some people coming up to me and saying, I read the article in the newspaper. But by that time, they'd all gotten to know me as a person. And also, it was almost the end of my time there, so they weren't going to fire me 2 weeks before I was going to leave. But because they'd gotten to know me as a person, they were much more open. And I remember that happened to my husband also, that we used to go out on book distribution once a week on Sunday on Orchard Street. And he ended up distributing a bag to Godhead to his boss's wife. And he came into work the next morning, and the boss calls him in the office and say, what's this? But because he'd worked there for a long time and they'd gotten to know him as a person, it became something favorable rather than unfavorable. So I used to concentrate on things like that, and I think that those are important and those are valuable to talk about. But more important and more valuable is looking at what are our core beliefs about how we should interact with alien cultures. I think you can also tell from this discussion that where you are on this continuum and where ISKCON is on this continuum is a great source of stress in our ISKCON society. We have some persons in our society who are preaching all the way at the extreme of this, and others who are preaching all the way at the extreme of this, and they come into a lot of conflict. They have a really hard time keeping that kirtan quiet, don't they? They can have it quiet for like 5 minutes, and then it keeps escalating and escalating. They forget all about us poor souls here in the seminar room without a mic. So I know I haven't given you an easy answer. I haven't given you like a pat answer. As I said, this was going to be a challenging seminar, and one that was going to, I hope, make you question where you stand on this continuum. I guess I could also say that it is a continuum. You know, that each of us we're somewhere on the line. Very few of us are at one particular place, and I think that most of us flow along this line in different areas of our life. So there may be certain areas where we have this view, and certain areas we have this view, and certain areas where we even have this view. But to whatever extent, as we're moving toward this end of the scale, we naturally become an other or an alien in alien cultures. And everyone stigmatizes an other. Everyone stigmatizes an other. An other, an alien, someone who's an other. Someone who's different. Someone who's not of your kind. There was a very famous song, I don't know if you remember this, when I was young, called Society's Child, about a white girl who was dating a black boy. And she said, you know, you come to my door, and my mother says, well, honey, he's not our kind. He's not our kind. So we tend to want to be with people who are our kind. We see others as other. They're other kind. So the more exclusive a position we take with regard to culture, the more we will appear to be an other. The more we will appear to be of a different kind. And if one wants the kind of support that this gives, one has to tolerate that. That is one's tapasya. And if one wants the kind of depth that this gives, then one has to do the sacrifice of deep thought and dialogue. And if one wants the freedom that this gives, well, then you lose your support. Does that make sense to everybody?
You know, it's a little hazy on the difference between dialogue and relativistic.
Okay, relativistic says that culture is value neutral, which, of course, is in one sense absurd, because the definition of culture is the external representation of values and meaning. That's what culture is. But this view says culture is basically value neutral. I can take the culture and have it mean whatever I want it to mean. I can ascribe new meanings to cultural behaviors. I can connect the meanings of my spirituality with any cultural representation. Whereas dialogic says there are some aspects of the alien culture that express things that also are expressed in my native culture. It may express them differently, but expressing the same values. And I can look for those things. And I can adjust how I express my values and how I express my meaning. Just like I gave the example in the beginning, that Indian and American culture expresses respect in an opposite way in terms of serving guests. Food. So in India, you show respect by putting food on people's plate that they say they don't want. That's how you show respect. In America, that's how you show disrespect. So that's a behavior, that's an external manifestation that has different meanings in different cultures. So a dialogic view says, okay, I can attach a different meaning to this behavior. I can mix things.
In fact, isn't there a lot of practical implications about devotional lives? In Gaudiya Vaishnavism, I've seen it's not exclusivity. In fact, much more so if you go to India, out there, like, don't wear a tilak. They would look down upon you, especially in some sections of Gaudiya Vaishnavas. So, in fact, in our own life, how do we decrease the tendency toward exclusivity? Because, like, I've seen sometimes some very good devotees, they are turned away because they realize that the interactions with other devotees have been exclusive.
Prabhu, I want to say again that none of these are bad or good. You'll find support from Srila Prabhupada for any of them, although you'll definitely find more support for these than for this. I don't believe that any of that, I personally do not believe that any of these are absolutely right or absolutely wrong. Now, in an idealistic sense, I'd say this is absolutely right. In other words, boy, if the whole world would be Vedic culture, it would be really easy to be a devotee. It would give natural support to being a devotee. There wouldn't be a struggle with outside cultural elements. So in that sense, you could say that the exclusive position is absolutely right. But the exclusive position in a world where you can't do that, the only way you can live exclusively is to form your own ghetto and never go out and never bring anybody in. It's the only way you can do it. Never bring in anyone from alien cultures and never go out into the alien culture. So I'm not saying that any of these are a solution. I'm leaving this open. I'm saying this has pros and cons, this has pros and cons, this has pros and cons. Yes?
First, would it be fair to say that the spread of Islamic culture was exclusivistic and Christian culture was biological?
I'd say the spread of Islamic culture was not at all exclusive because, you know, Islam started in the Middle East and they have very successfully been able to have people be Muslims in various cultures of the world. They have definitely... They're somewhere around here with being dialogic and relativistic. In fact, like Indonesia is the place where I think you find the most Muslims. And they have not disrupted Indonesian culture. They've pretty much maintained Indonesian culture, which is a relativistic point of view. They've kept the culture and they've infused it with Islam. And definitely one of the, if you want to spread a religion, and this is the claim of the proponents of a relativistic view, is that if you really want to spread your spirituality, don't mess with the culture. Leave the culture as it is. I mean, obviously you have to change some things. People wouldn't be able to drink beer and eat beef. But, you know, basically leave the culture as it is and you just infuse it with Krishna consciousness. Again, your problem with that, and I think we see this with Islam, is that you may lose your spirituality. You may not, you know, because every culture has an innate spiritual system connected with it. So you may end up with something that's not your original spiritual system. People all the way on this end can't, by definition, they can't preach. By definition, preaching is impossible or greatly discouraged.
So there are no examples of major cultural transformations from the exclusivistic point of view.
By definition, it's impossible.
In history, there's no.
I mean, maybe you can think of some. But you really can't. If you really hold this to an absolute extreme, which would be like the Amish. The Amish hold this to an extreme. They say that their culture is the only authentic representation of their spirituality, and it is difficult to become an Amish. They highly discourage you from becoming an Amish. You know, the Amish people cannot work out in the general society, and people from the general society cannot join their community and become Amish. There's a total, sorry, you know, you have an alien culture, that's it. I mean, there are people who are, to a large extent, exclusive and who preach, but they've got to adopt some of these other things in order to preach, because as soon as you're preaching, you're interacting with alien cultures. I mean, you can, I suppose, try to destroy the alien cultures that you encounter. Yes.
The phenomenon right now of Islamic terrorism is something to talk about. We're mentioning that in our society there's tugs between these not polar opposites, but different approaches to things. So the it's kind of like the terrorists would be considered exclusives. They want everybody to be in their exclusive.
Yeah, well, that you see that.
That's for us.
Yes. Yeah, you could say that the Muslim terrorists are people trying to be totally exclusive and preach.
Yeah, there you go. And if you don't like what they're saying, they're going
to
blow you up.
Yeah, they're trying to be preachers who are totally exclusive. But also, they're reacting not so much to other alien cultures of other religions. They're reacting to the two global secular cultures, much more so than to alien cultures. Before there was these two kinds of global secular cultures, you didn't see, I mean, the Muslims were, of course, always very violent in their conquests, but you didn't see the same kind of behavior that you see today. So there, because you've got to remember, each local alien culture has a religion associated with it, whereas the global secular culture, their religion is atheism. Two different global cultures. This is a little technical and academic. One is modernism or positivism. The other is postmodernism or post-positivism. Modernism is what we call empirical science. There is an objective truth. This objective truth can be understood through the senses and the mind. Anything beyond the brain. Anything beyond the senses and the brain doesn't exist, is irrelevant, has no meaning. Subjective experience has no meaning. There is no such thing as subjective experience. We don't care about subjective experience. We're just interested in science and empiricism and reason. Postmodernism or post-positivism says either there is no such thing as an objective truth, or if there is, it's irrelevant because nobody can find out what it is through empiricism anyway, which we agree with. We agree that you cannot find an absolute truth through logic and senses. So they're saying that it's irrelevant. They're saying that all there is senses and logic. You can't use those to find the absolute truth. So the absolute truth is irrelevant. Therefore, anybody's view of the absolute truth is equal, is the same. And this is the whole basis of modern multiculturalism. So the positivistic view is that everyone who comes to America has to become an American. The post-positivistic view is everyone who comes to America should be allowed to retain their own culture and their own language and their own customs because everything is equally valid. And the positivists are against religion because they say religion is something, it's just something ephemeral and mystical. It's not senses and logic. And therefore, it's got to be talking about something nonsense. How can it be talking about something that's truth? And the post-positivists don't like religion because religion is positing an absolute truth. And they're saying there is no absolute truth. Everything is, of course they are. They're saying it's absolutely true that there's no absolute truth. Which shows you that there must be an absolute truth because nobody can come up with a philosophy that denies an absolute truth, but that's a whole other discussion. Yeah. But they don't like religion because religion is positing an absolute truth. Religion is saying some people are right and some people are wrong, and the post-positivists say everyone's right. Of course, also the post-positivists don't really think that everybody's right. They don't think that Nazi culture is okay. So even the post-positivists have some line of morality. You know, neither positivism nor post-positivism is a practically applicable, livable philosophy. Again, that's a whole other discussion. But both of those philosophies are heavily preaching against religion. They coexist, they fight with each other as well, but they're heavily preaching against religion and they're all over the world. And the Muslim extremists are mostly aghast at that culture and trying to stop that culture, which they tend to identify with European and American culture. It's not really. Traditional American and European culture is something different. But it is the Americans and Europeans who are mostly spreading these two kinds of global secular culture all over the world. Yes, Marsh.
Just from my understanding, positivism is this philosophy associated with Kant, here this Kant.
Yeah.
And later on with the Vienna Circle and that whole thing.
Yes.
Okay. Bhaktivinoda talks about it, and I've read about that.
Well, Bhaktivinoda is going to be dealing mostly with positivism because post-positivism didn't exist so much in his day. Post-positivism is a much more recent philosophy. It's much more the Yathamat Tathapat as far as Western and global philosophy. As I said,
philosophy is almost perennial philosophy, but not so much for the divine being.
Yes. Yes.
Even if you follow the
yes.
Like, assuming that, yes, we integrated ourselves into society, we wear the blue jeans, we go to work, we do everything. We hide the Kunti Mala, we have a polo shirt.
Well, you don't have a Kunti Mala.
Yeah, it's like you don't wear Kunti Mala or something. But then, because you're integrating Hare Krishna philosophy into it, you might not do stuff that is culturally acceptable.
Yes.
But
it's going to be, it's almost impossible to be 100% relativistic or 100% exclusivist. It's almost impossible. If you were 100% exclusive, as I said, you couldn't preach and you couldn't. We have some devotees in ISKCON who haven't left a temple property for 35 years and never speak to guests and never interact with the outside society. I've met a few of them. But how many people can live like that? So to be 100% exclusive is not a practical philosophy. It's even hard for the Amish and the Orthodox Jews to be 100% exclusive. To be 100% relativistic, also, then you wouldn't even be able to be vegetarian. You know, so I don't think anyone's propounding, that's why I'm saying it's a continuum. But the people who are saying that we should be relativistic, many times they're not wearing Kunti Mala. You know, they're adopting all of the cultural norms, or most of the cultural norms of the outside
society. My question is, how do you deal with being stigmatized in a relativistic society? Because even then, like
my suggestion for how to deal with it on a deep level is to say, what choice am I making as an individual as to how I'm dealing with the alien culture? Again, I could talk about things like be nice to the people at work, and give them raisin prasadam. I did that too. I was supposed to give Christmas gifts to everyone, so I bought tons of little raisin boxes and offered them and gave that out. You know, I could talk about little things like that, but my suggestion is you go to the root of your attitude and say, what do I believe? What do I personally believe? Not what I think I'm supposed to believe, which is a little different. What do I personally believe? Where am I here? When I studied this, I realized that I'm way over here. And I realized that being way over here had some sacrifices in my life and caused some sacrifices and some difficulties in the lives of my children. But I never thought about it that way until I looked at this kind of thing. So you decide, where am I? What do I believe? And then whatever you believe, there's some price. And then you have to look at it and say, am I willing to pay that price? If you're not willing to pay that price, you might want to consciously and intentionally move somewhere on this line. Everywhere you are on this line, you're paying some price. It's a question of saying, what price am I comfortable with paying? And then the price you want to pay becomes your offering to Krishna. Just like in the ashrams, if you want to have money and a house and the opposite sex, and then you pay a certain price, and the price you pay is your offering. At least according to Bhakti Siddhanta Brahma Samhita Purport 561. And then the pleasures you get are prasanna. So if you're thinking, oh, I gotta work, I gotta earn money, I gotta earn a job. But if you say, I want to enjoy a home and money and wife, husband, I want to enjoy these things. That's my nature right now. Okay, this is the tapasya I pay in order to legitimately enjoy those things. That's karma yoga. Step beyond is then I offer that tapasya to Krishna. That's my offering to Krishna. The working, the dealing with the husband, the taking care of the children, the paying the insurance, the fixing the plumbing. That's my offering. And the pleasures that I get from that ashram, that's my prasanna. And you say, well, really, that's not what I want to enjoy. What I want to enjoy is I want to enjoy freedom and simplicity. Okay, then you have a different sacrifice. Krishna explains different kinds of sacrifice, fourth chapter, Bhagavad Gita. Everybody has to sacrifice. Then you do a different sacrifice. Then you have to sacrifice that you don't have very many possessions. That's a sacrifice. You don't have 5 different coats and 10 different pairs of boots and 40 different saris. You only have 4 different saris. My friend Kalangana said to me in London, Ermila, you always wear the same sari. I said, no, it's just that all 4 of my saris look pretty much exactly the same. This one's got a different color border. So they know, then you only have 4 saris. Then maybe you don't have a home. Maybe you don't have a bank account. That's your tapasya. And then you offer that tapasya to Krishna. And then the freedom and the simplicity you get, you enjoy that as your prasanna. That's Nishkam Karma Yoga. Then if you go a little higher, then what you're really enjoying is just the giving and take, the exchange of love between you and Krishna. You're giving Krishna gifts and he's giving you gifts and you're enjoying the exchange of love. And at a higher level, then you're just enjoying that Krishna's happy. And that's true with this too. How do I want to personally balance my life as a practitioner of the Hare Krishna in an alien culture, and I'm dealing with at least three alien cultures here in America. I'm dealing with the American culture, I'm dealing with the global positivistic culture, and I'm dealing with the global post-positivistic culture. What's my choice as to how to deal with them? And what sacrifice am I willing to make? And each one is going to give you certain benefits and certain downsides. And to look at that honestly. And if you don't like the way it is, change it. And be willing to take that sacrifice. And my suggestion is also, as you raise your children, be honest with them about these choices and what sacrifices are entailed. That there, you know, that there are other choices, there are other ways of doing it, but what are the prices? And what prices are you comfortable with? For me, I'd rather pay the price of being stigmatized than lose the support, the cultural support. But that's my choice. That's not everybody's choice. Does that make sense? Yes. Excuse me? Oh, thank you. This, I thought this was a really revolutionary seminar. I was almost gave it in my school, and I was too scared. I'm a little too scared. I am going to be giving it at the Scholars Conference in Italy, not with the lens of stigma, and I'm going to be looking at it in terms of children's education and the culture of education. I think as a society, these are very difficult questions to answer. And what I'm seeing happening in ISKCON is that different parts of ISKCON society are different places on this line. That different leaders, different centers are different places on this line. That we are no longer a monolithic approach to alien cultures. I think we did a long time ago. A long time ago, we were highly exclusive. Yes?
What do you see as the effect on this changed approach to alien culture?
What effect do I see on this kind?
Yeah, as we go forward. Because alien cultures change.
Well, I see that ISKCON, as in general, has become more dialogic and more relativistic. And as a reaction to that, certain parts of ISKCON have become much more exclusive. So there's certain temples and certain communities you can go to that are highly exclusive and very proud of it and very vocal about it. And what are the changes that have happened? It's allowed us to become more of a society. Because since we haven't established our own society, we haven't, you know, we didn't establish huge farming community. Well, we tried to. That could accommodate tens of thousands of people. And we didn't establish our own counter-society like the Amish have done. The only way to establish a society was to start having some kind of a dialogue with the alien culture, because all of a sudden our members had to live in the alien culture. So it's allowed us to become a society rather than just a monastic order. And without a society, it's ICON. It's not ISKCON. But on the other hand, it's made it so that many of our members have lost that kind of cultural support and identity that they have. And we still have a lot of angst and confusion in our members about whether or not Vedic culture, whatever that is the only authentic way to express their Krishna consciousness. Okay, I'm supposed to end now? But anyway, we still have, I'd say one of the top five questions that I get as I travel all over the world is, how do I balance my life? And how do I be a devotee out in the world? One of the top five questions. So I think that these are things that ISKCON as a society is still wrestling with. And I don't even pretend to have any answers for the society as a whole. I'm just presenting this model for your consideration. Thank you very, very much for tolerating this.
Thank you.
Without seeing the PowerPoint, without having a microphone with the loud kirtan next door. By the way, just one second. Tomorrow I'm giving a completely different kind of seminar. I'm going to be giving a seminar tomorrow.